Most of us, if we are honest, will admit that there's often a difference between how we measure the conduct of other people and how we judge the same behavior when it is we ourselves doing it. We may become annoyed by someone else's driving, either they're reckless or too slow or tailgating, but when we do the same, we find a reason to justify it. We see this in our reluctance to accept change, or especially to accept responsibility, unless it is of our own making. Again, not to reflect always on my experience teaching, but I do remember certain teachers who wanted students severely punished for relatively small infractions. And for some reason, I recall this young man, Harry, who would have graduated 10 years ago. And at a rally, Harry was running around pretending to take pictures. It turned out at that time there wasn't film on the camera. And I remember seemingly a minor matter became a major discipline issue when this particular teacher, who was a little creative with financing, as it turns out, with his department, wanted this student expelled. I've often found that with those who call for someone to be essentially beheaded, their own lives reflect behavior that is far worse. Again, there is a large difference between how we judge the behavior of others and how we view our own. Which leads to an important lesson, the first lesson from our gospel this morning. We are told that the unjust servant expected his master to have patience with him and to give him an extension on his loan repayment. The master was not only patient, but we're told he generously forgave the whole debt. The original text, the translation, uses the word 10,000 talents. Scripture scholars tell us that 10,000 was the largest number in the ancient scale of counting. From it, we derive the English word myriad. A talent was the largest denomination of money in the ancient world, the equivalent to perhaps a $10,000 bill or whatever our largest dollar bill happens to be today. A talent would have been roughly 15 years' wages for the average servant. And again, house scholars know this, but they have written that King Herod was believed to have made about 900 talents a year. But we're told again that the unjust servant ignores the pleading of his fellow servant, who owed him a mere fraction. And then we're told that he had him thrown into prison. This blindness is essentially a refusal to apply the same criteria to ourselves as we apply to other people. Why do so many of us behave this way? Probably because we lack self-knowledge, and we refuse to look honestly at ourselves and to see how we really are. Now, this theme permeates both testaments of Scripture. Recall the second book of Samuel, King David and Bathsheba, who is married to one of David's soldiers, Uriah. David has Uriah placed in the line of fire, and he is killed. The prophet Nathan later visits David and tells the story of a poor man and his family and their lamb. The neighboring rich landowner with his own large flocks takes the poor man's only lamb and feeds it to his friends at a banquet. David is outraged at this story and declares that that rich man should be killed for what he has done. Then Nathan says to David, "You are that man." David saw the reality of what he had done and how he behaved, and he repented. Other examples of blindness are in John's gospel, with Judas complaining that the expense of oil used to anoint Jesus' feet could be sold to feed the poor. Yet we know that he was stealing money from the treasury, the money that was raised to support Jesus and the apostles' ministry. Then, of course, the Pharisees and the refusal to help people who are hurt on the Sabbath and yet seeing nothing wrong in violating that same prohibition if it was a benefit to them. Why this blindness to our own wrong behavior? Why does it receive such emphasis in the Scriptures? Because there can be no growth in holiness without self-knowledge. This fact brings the gospel into direct conflict with our culture, in which there's so much denial and refusal to accept responsibilities for one's actions. You may have heard of a book called The Vanishing American Adult, Our Coming-of-Age Crisis, by one of the senators from Nebraska, Ben Sasse, who is a husband and a father, I've been a university president and a practicing Presbyterian. He attempts to address the growing problem of what he called perpetual adolescence, often reinforced in our educational system, that he said promotes individual expression and rights but downplays personal responsibility and ignores many of the ideas and ideals that have led to responsible, self-reflective, and self-sacrifice for the good of others. Now, one commentator attributes this lack of self-knowledge to many reasons, including the denial of suffering or sacrifice, the denial of aging, and the embracing of a rugged individualism. I would reduce it simply to a lack of humility. And remember, humility is truth. It's how God sees us, not necessarily others or ourselves. Now, the first important lesson is this gospel calls us to forgiveness. But forgiveness implies an understanding of our own spiritual poverty, our own brokenness and sin, and therefore our need to be forgiven as we are forgiven by God calls forth our need to forgive others. This enables us to forgive with understanding and humility, and there are lessons hopefully learned at home and reinforced in the faith community we call our church. Finally, a second point to our gospel today. In the 5th century, St. Augustine said that forgiveness was like a mother who has two daughters named Justice and Compassion. In using such a metaphor, Augustine knew that forgiveness was not a one-time event, that it was a process that involved other virtues as well. Now, in our gospel, the king is just. He's compassionate and he's forgiven. He rightly expects that in turn, his servant or steward would do the same. So often it's easy to be forgiving in the big picture. We talk about conflicts in foreign nations, but it's another to forgive those closest to us. Perhaps some helpful steps for us as we apply this gospel to our lives today. The first is we must recognize that a wrong has been done to us. There's no point in pretending it didn't happen. The second, we have to recognize that when we've been hurt, that we have feelings about this, including anger. These feelings are not sins. They're natural and they're healthy. The third is we should talk about them, hopefully to the one who has hurt us. But if not, someone else. Maybe in the sacrament of confession, which gives us grace. Four, then at some point, we have to make a decision to forgive. Now, this is an important distinction. Forgiveness is an act of the will. It doesn't mean that feelings of hurt and bitterness will suddenly disappear. Healing takes time. Finally, we have to make a decision about our relationship with the person who's hurt us. We have three choices: continue it, break it off for a while, or discontinue it altogether. Reconciliation is not always possible. Remember, it takes two to be reconciled, and Jesus didn't say reconcile 70 times seven. Sometimes the people we ask to forgive us will not forgive us. We need to pray for the grace to forgive. And unless we forgive, we will not be able to let go of bitterness and resentment, and thus we will not know peace and healing. Forgiveness does not mean forgetting it. It means remembering and letting go. It is a holy task and one that only God can help make possible. Finally, an example from history. Sadly, in this cancel culture in which we live, where they're destroying statues and tearing down great individuals such as Abraham Lincoln, and I've often wondered that those responsible for this have contributed absolutely nothing to society and to the good of men and women. But the great President Abraham Lincoln, elected, as we know, on the anti-slavery ticket, the election that precipitated the Civil War, he was opposed to all forms of slavery, and not least people becoming slaves of their own anger and resentment. His Secretary of War was Edwin Stanton, and he had trouble with a major general who accused him in abusive terms of favoritism. Stanton went to President Lincoln and complained to him, and Lincoln suggested that he write the officer a very stern letter. The Secretary of War, Stanton, did so, and he showed the strongly worded statement to the President, who applauded him for his clear and powerful language. "What are you going to do with it?" he asked. And surprised at the question, Secretary of War Stanton said, "I'm going to send it, of course." President Lincoln shook his head. "You don't want to send that letter." He said, "Put it in the stove. That's what I do when I've written a letter when I'm angry. It's a good letter, and you had a good time writing it and feel better. Now burn it and write another." Lincoln could have followed the advice of today's reading from the book of Sirach. Clearly, Lincoln, a man of faith, lived these words. It's on the futility of vengeance. Recall from Sirach, our first reading, "If a man nurses anger against another, can he then demand compassion from the Lord? Showing no pity for a man like himself, can he then plead for his own sins?" As we continue our Mass this morning, let us be clear. Nursing anger and cherishing resentment is dangerous not only for our spiritual but our physical health. Indeed, it can be fatal. It disables us and renders us defenseless when we look for our own sins to be forgiven. Perhaps our prayer tonight before we go to sleep might be simply the word, "Be merciful to me, O Lord, I am a sinner."